Ben Collier is a lecturer in digital methods at the University of Edinburgh's School of Social and Political Science. He joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his book, Tor, From the Dark Web to the Future of Privacy. The book is a biography of the technology and browser that have become central to the so-called dark web. Ben believes the association of the dark web and Tor with cybercrime is overstated in the media. The reality is complicated.
Tor, initially, it wasn't particularly useful for crime because no one really knew how to use it. It wasn't very easy to use. It was very slow. And there was no easy way to send money over it. Obviously, when you get the rise of cryptocurrency, particularly initially Bitcoin, suddenly now you can send money anonymously, or well, you can send money without being censored, and now you can browse anonymously. So this led to crypto markets being created that put these two technologies together. But Tor is not intrinsically a technology for crime. And actually, to be honest, if you want to see crime on the internet, social media is probably the place to go.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network. And maybe today we'll call it the Plutopia Dark Web. Today we're joined by someone whose work digs deep into the darker, more complicated side of our digital world. Ben Collier is a senior lecturer in digital methods at the University of Edinburgh, and he's the chair of the Foundation for Information Policy Research. His research examines how digital infrastructure and emerging technologies, from social platforms to digital systems to AI, become entangled with harm, crime, power, and control. We'll be talking about Ben's book, Tor, From the Dark Web to the Future of Privacy, recently published by MIT Press. The book is about Tor, a cultural and technological history of power, privacy, and global politics at the internet's core. The Tor Project is a nonprofit organization that has to do with onions, for one thing, we'll get to that, that develops and maintains free open source software, including the Tor network and browser, to enable anonymous communication and defend online privacy by routing internet traffic through a global network of volunteer operated relays. It's also known as the infrastructure underpinning the so-called dark web. So, Ben, welcome to the show. And to start off, I guess my first question is, what first led you to focus your research on the ways technology intersects with harm and control? Was there like a particular moment in your research or in your career that made you realize that Tor and the ecosystem around it needed a deeper public conversation?
Great to be here, guys, and thanks for having me. Yes, I think there really was. Well, not so much a moment as basically my entire childhood. So growing up, I was very much from the age of about 5 or 6. I started messing around with my dad's was BBC Basic on an old ZX81 Spectrum. So I started trying to build my own video games from a young age. And then across my sort of childhood and teens, got really into kind of hacker culture, you know, the usual stuff, films, online sites, things like this. I did then weirdly did a degree in chemistry. So I spent 5 years being a chemist, mixing things in test tubes. But then I decided that wasn't really for me. So I became a criminologist. And throughout the course of studying to be a criminologist, I was really interested in computer hackers and particularly in technology. There'd been loads and loads of writing about computer hacker culture, but actually very little writing about how people use technology or where the technologies that hackers, cyber criminals, and the police use, where they actually come from. And so I was really interested in studying Tor for my PhD. I literally sat down in my supervisor's office on day one and said, I really want to study something to do with technology and crime and hacking. And he said, well, you're going to have to choose something to study then. So I went away and I chose Tor.
Was that with Ross Anderson?
No, so Ross came later. That's another very odd story.
I don't mean to derail you. I just wondered who you were talking about. as
No,
you.
it's so my supervisors were Rich Jones and James Stewart. And the funny thing about Ross is, so I write about Ross a lot in the book. So I spent 4 years of a PhD studying Tor, interviewing everyone I could get my hands on that had ever been associated with the Tor project. And then halfway through that process, I started a job under Ross at Cambridge and Alice Hutchings. And I had no idea that Ross had been involved in Tor and in cryptography and privacy since the mid-90s. He was there throughout the whole thing. And yeah, he was just a guy that I sat next to at lunch for the first year. And then, yeah, then he became a much bigger part of the story.
Maybe you should say a little bit about the technology and particularly about the onion routing paradigm.
Yeah, so this is a thing people often misunderstand about Tor. It is kind of how it works and where it comes from. So Tor's story really starts in the mid 1990s at the Naval Research Lab of essentially the United States Navy, and they were trying to solve a particular problem with the internet. So as the internet was spreading through commercial and business and everyday people using it around the world, the Navy started getting really interested in it, and they thought, well, can we actually use this for secure communications? Is it possible to have secure communications on the internet, given the fact that wherever you are, the government, wherever you are, basically controls the internet? So if you're in China, the Chinese government could see who's speaking to who on the internet. That's bad if you're the US Navy, because it means they can see all the communications going back and forth. And so they say, well, the analogy would be, can I send a letter through the postal system without a to and a from address? So the actual postal network can get it where it needs to go, but without knowing where it came from and where it's going to. So obviously a really hard technical problem, seems impossible, right? But these three people, Goldschlag, Syverson, and Reed at the Naval Research Lab, come up with a clever design. They say, well, what if we have this global network of relays, and we bundle up your internet traffic in three layers of encryption, so like an onion. You push this onion into the network, and the first node decrypts the first layer. So it knows where you came from. And when it decrypts that first layer, it knows the next node in the network. So it knows where you came from, but it doesn't know where you're going. The next layer gets decrypted by the next node. So it just knows the node you came from and the node you're going to. So it doesn't know where you came from or where you're going to originally. The next node, the final node, the exit node, decrypts that last layer of traffic and it gets the final destination, but it doesn't know where the traffic came from. And once you've done this, it's sort of practical magic. You can get letters over the internet or signals or traffic or communications, and the internet itself doesn't know where the traffic came from or where it's going. So this like layered structure is why it's called the onion routing. And it's very clever. Loads of stuff came after that. They had a lot of difficulties figuring out how you'd make this actually work in practice, but that's the basics.
And they often refer to Tor or associate it with the dark web, scary and mysterious, like terrible things going on, probably malicious intent, with some of the operators on this dark and terrible place. How do you, I mean, obviously a misconception, obviously to us, but how do you deal with this and I guess other misconceptions about Tor?
It's difficult. It's obviously quite useful for me that it's seen as this sort of cool, exciting, dark, dangerous thing. Because if I'm speaking to like the police or government or people in private companies, and I say, well, I'm an expert in Tor and the dark web, that makes me seem more interesting, even though actually it's a much more everyday thing. So the highest traffic site on the dark web for a long time was Facebook. That is because if you hide where your traffic comes from and is going to, it makes it very difficult to censor that traffic. So you can't stop people seeing things. And a lot of American companies, particularly communications companies like Facebook or news companies like the British BBC, even organizations like the CIA and the FBI, found it really useful to set up darknet websites or dark web websites, because it means that people in China can then access the news. They can access, and the government in their country can't stop them accessing that. There was a bigger, so the big, where people have always used all sorts of internet technologies and all sorts of security technologies for crime. For Tor, initially, it wasn't particularly useful for crime because no one really knew how to use it. It wasn't very easy to use. It was very slow. And there was no easy way to send money over it. Obviously, when you get the rise of cryptocurrency, particularly initially Bitcoin, suddenly now you can send money anonymously, or well, you can send money without being censored. And now you can browse anonymously. So this led to crypto markets being created that put these two technologies together. But Tor is not intrinsically a technology for crime. And actually, to be honest, if you want to see crime on the internet, social media is probably the place to go.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book that that they weren't actually all that thr the people designing Tor weren't all that thrilled when the criminals showed up.
Not at all. Yeah, I think they were partly because they wanted Tor to become another standard. They wanted it to become like just part of how the internet worked. They wanted more and more sites to be able to use Tor, to integrate with Tor, to just give people better insecurity, sorry, better security and privacy in the way that encryption gives us better security and privacy. So I think for them, people using Tor for crime, they weren't too happy about it.
How about the cypherpunks? I mean, I hung out with those guys back in the day. I didn't really realize until I read your book to what extent they were involved in the creation of Tor. Can you say a little bit about their role?
So that's really fun. It's the bit it's my favorite bit of the book because it's the one that makes you go, what on earth is happening here? So essentially what happened was when these three naval researchers got together and decided to build this new type of anonymity technology, so a network distributed all over the world that would basically allow people to do secret communications, they realized right away that there was a huge problem. And that's if you set up a network that only the US Navy use, then the Chinese government or the Russian government can just say, oh, look, they're connecting to that secret US military network. So we know they're probably a bit dodgy. Similarly, to actually run these relays, if they're run by the US military or the CIA, no one's going to trust it. So what they needed was a system that had lots and lots and lots of just everyday people using it, and that wasn't run by the military, it was run by everyday people. And so that's a bit of a bind to be in. And it turns out they were going to all the same privacy conferences, security conferences, cryptography conferences that the cypherpunks were. So these kind of like radical techno-libertarian kind of technologists who were building privacy technologies for the general public. And they got talking and they said, well, actually, we've got a lot in common. The cypherpunks want general use privacy for the general population. And the military wants this sort of super secret network. And so actually, they've got an interest in common. They both want a more private internet that lots of people use. The cyberpunks want lots of people use it because it's good. The military want lots of people to use it because it gives them cover traffic they can hide their agents in. And so they got together and they had a number of meetings. They then went to a famous cyberpunk's house for something called the Onion Dinner. Where they served up entirely onion-based food, and talked about like, well, you know, what's going to work for the cypherpunks? What do you think the general public will use? And yeah, they actually collaborated on the earliest sort of bits of the system. So you have this very odd, incredibly odd dynamic where the US military are collaborating with sort of these libertarian, freewheeling hackers out of a 1990s film, basically.
It's not so different, though, from, you know, some of the time in the 90s in the internet, in talking about the internet itself, where you had, you know, you had someone like John Postel, who was running the domain name system at the time, you know, this academic, barefoot academic in jeans, showing up at, you know, government committees to talk to them about how it all worked, you know. I mean, they always kind of, I think all the powers that be kind of had to accept that some of the techie people they wanted to work with were a little odd.
Yes, I couldn't possibly comment about long-haired academics getting in to talk with
You're
them.
not barefoot, Ben. You're
He's
living
not
in
the one
Edinburgh, not, you're
I'm
living
How
in
do you know
Edinburgh,
he's
not
not
Southern
barefoot?
California.
That
Because he's in Edinburgh and it's cold in Edinburgh,
is
it's
very
not
true.
Southern
Well,
California.
it's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, if you go online and you inquire about the dark web and about Tor, it immediately lists out the evil parts cybercrime as a service, illicit marketplaces, and just a long list of really, you know, scary things. But, you know, from reading your book, it seems that that is not the majority of what's going on in the so-called dark web.
Absolutely. I think the reason for that is that most people who use the dark web to do other things, they probably don't even realize they're using it. So a lot of the time these services will get set up. They don't advertise the fact that it's over Tor because of some of the negative connotations, but it's sort of built into the background. So for example, The Guardian, The New York Times, Washington Post use a service called SecureDrop, or it did for a long period of time. Now that's all based on sort of Tor technologies. They use that for whistleblowers, but they don't, you wouldn't, if you go looking for Tor stuff, you'll tend to get the stuff that's a bit sort of edgier because it's sort of marketing itself with that kind of dark web brand. But the vast majority of people, as far as they're able to tell, that use Tor, just use it for day-to-day web browsing. And a lot of the time it's for a censorship circumvention, I think, particularly in countries with heavily censored internet. We actually see this in the UK. We saw a huge uptick in the use of Tor when the Online Safety Act came into play over the summer. So people having to sort of upload a photograph of their face to use social media. You start to see a lot more people using Tor because they find out that when they use Tor, they don't have to do that. It routes it through Germany or it routes it through France. And so actually you just get a very different experience of using the internet.
Has the change in our administration here in the States, you know, the Trump administration, has that had an impact on Tor and on the dark web? Because they have a different approach to just about everything, and it's not a very friendly approach.
Yeah, there's been some really complicated effects on Tor, both as an organization and on the user base. You have seen more people using it. That's partly due to the kind of, it's partly due to more people being worried about government surveillance. It's also, I think, there's a weird contradictory effect there, which is that a lot of the people in the orbit of Donald Trump are really into kind of cryptocurrency and like privacy technologies. So that gives it a bit of a boost as well. So it's kind of, I think adoption has benefited from both. In terms of where it's put Tor as an organization, it's put it in quite an odd position. Because Tor for a long time has sold itself very much as kind of like a bastion of human rights, a bastion of sort of like liberal, democratic sort of politics around the world, very much that kind of global public policy of the US, which Donald Trump's done a lot to try to dismantle through things like cancelling a lot of US aid funding and a lot of the funding that Tor drew on. So that's been a really bad thing for Tor. But simultaneously, a lot of the crypto communities who have a lot of money and who really like Tor have got a big boost in the Trump administration. So I think it's really shifted those kind of underlying dynamics of power between the different supporters of the Tor project, which is quite a diverse community of people with very completely different politics, all quite like Tor.
Well, you mentioned the Tor browser. There wasn't always a Tor browser. Kind of, how did that come to be, and what was the significance of creating a browser that incorporated the technology?
Yeah, so when it kind of started, certainly for the first few years, Tor was an absolute pain to use. It was very much, the early users were very much like people that were used to cobbling together lots of bits and pieces of technology to get something to happen. A lot of them were like the file sharing community or like the early hacker communities, things like that. But when they started getting more mainstream users, particularly from like NGOs that operate around the world that need security, they realized that, and I mean, at this point, you had to operate about 12 different programs on your computer, get them all running, get some sort of stuff running largely in the command line. It like a real pain. And they decided, well, actually, this isn't going to work for most people. What we need is a single thing you can download, a bundle that runs it all. And you click on it, install it, it just works like a normal browser. So that was basically invented by, not solely, but largely by Stephen Murdoch, who's now a professor at UCL, who's also on. It's quite odd that when I wrote the book, I didn't really know any of these people. But now I know them really well. So Stephen's actually in the organization I chair, FIPR. Which is odd. I didn't think 5 years ago I'd be saying I knew all these people.
Ben is talking about the Foundation for Information Policy Research. It's kind of a think tank in that it tries to come up with evidence that campaigners can use on various topics. And when I mentioned Ross Anderson before, it was his he was the fa he was one of the founders, and he ran it himself for a long time, and then he died very suddenly a couple of years ago. And Ben is the new chair, and there's a new board, and I'm one of the board members. And so, so far it's looking good for FIPR 2.0.
It's open.
So what is it that the organization does exactly?
It tries to produce evidence that, sort of, when somebody starts promoting a policy like digital IDs, or which has come up recently, or let's scan all the encryption and make it available to law enforcement, FIPR tries to come up with evidence that campaigners can use to pour sense on the ideas.
Absolutely.
God, this
So,
makes me think about the old days. I interviewed Phil Zimmerman
oh yeah. Oh,
years
so did
ago.
I, and so did I in
Well, so I had published
1993.
my interview and I put it online, and I actually had to consult with an attorney, with Mike Godwin actually, about like, is that going to be a problem? Because this was when they started investigating Phil Zimmerman, and it looked like he might get like thrown in jail or something because somebody had ported PGP outside the United States, and that. At the time, I guess, was considered a crime.
It was a
And
crime. It was a crime at the time.
I said, well, I should probably take that interview down. And he said, well, then that would be obstruction. So I just left it anyway.
I interviewed him for The Guardian when the investigation was announced, and he begged me to write it as though I hadn't actually spoke to him, because his lawyers were saying that the Department of Justice would be unhappy, if they thought he was trying to sway public opinion. But actually, in the end, as far as I'm aware, the public opinion was actually part of what ended up helping him. But
But I mean, well, a lot of people just don't realize that crypto was it was considered munitions at the time.
that's
You know,
right.
when a lot of the stuff we're talking about, people started thinking about, we need crypto, and everybody should have crypto, and there, the government was deeply opposed to that.
Yep. And I remember writing the piece and worrying that I was going to cost him his house. Yeah.
I remember one of Ross's prized possessions whenever I went to his office at the Department of Computer Science and Technology, was one of the original t-shirts from the 1990s that they, so the way they got around, for your listeners, I'm aware that everyone on the call is well aware of this particular story. But yeah, getting around PGP being classified as munitions by printing it on a t-shirt, or printing the code on a t-shirt so it could be classified as speech instead. But yeah.
Yeah, and they and he and Zimmerman also shipped optical OCR readable, machine readable, the code to PGP in machine readable font in books, because books could go anywhere. For people who are watching this who don't know what PGP is, it stands for Pretty Good Privacy. It was a program invented by Philip Zimmerman in about 1991 or 92, and it was the first time that somebody with a personal computer could encrypt the data on their hard drive, or encrypt an email message they sent to someone else. And for people working in hostile environments, in human rights and things, it was a very useful thing. And it's still with us today in some form.
Yeah, back then people would put their public key on their emails, and but it was you had to take a couple extra steps to use it. So even though I had a PGP key, but I rarely used it. But it was the thought that counted, I think.
Yeah,
Well, I
back in
still
a
have a
previous
few.
lifetime, I was in medical IT in California, and they were very opposed to any kind of encryption. At first, I had no explanation that made any sense. They were afraid people were going to be stealing internal data and sending them out to their friends or something. But they finally had some medical records exposed to on the internet, and it was identified as our medical records. And suddenly PGP was the new, you know, save all and end all. And so it just took, you know, encounter with, you know, nefarious data stealers for them to, I mean, you know, figure out that PGP was good for protecting their data.
Well, that was part of how Ross Anderson got involved in this, is that there was a moment when they started talking about electronic health records in this country, which, you know, because National Health Service is a big thing, and, you know, it's kind of an obvious idea for a nationwide system. And he got involved with, you know, how those records were stored and things, because they weren't talking about encrypting them at all at the time. Anyway, Ben, I think one of the things that I think you write about particularly well is the thing that really, I mean, I still have a PGP key, but nobody likes to use it, because there are many, many ways you can make a mistake that that undoes the security of it. And I think one of the things you write about that really interested me was Tor's approach to usability, that, you know, they didn't let the perfect become the enemy of the good.
100%. And that was the big difference between the military people and some of the techies that came on. So people like Roger Dingledean, Nick Mattison, and some other people as well, between them and the cypherpunks. If you spoke to the cypherpunks, they wanted, because they were techies, they wanted the most secure system you could possibly have, that was secure against all possible adversaries. Even if the CIA's top people are on it, they can't stop you. The problem is those systems don't exist. They're completely unusable in real life. And particularly Roger Dingledean, who is the kind of current head of Tor, and it's a long-standing kind of one of the leading people within Tor, he recognized from a lot of things that were going on at the time, particularly in the file sharing movement, looking at other kind of privacy technologies, he saw that, well, no, a system that no one uses doesn't give you any privacy at all. So actually, all these complicated, weird things that we can add in, these different design features that like might give you some privacy, but make it much harder, slower to use. He just said, that's not what we're going to do. We want it to be the easiest possible bit of tech to use. And that will give people privacy, because of the design of Tor, the more people using Tor, the more people's traffic you're getting mixed up in. So actually, the bigger the user base, the more privacy you really get. So which is a really powerful thing for Tor, and actually was quite unique at the time, to the extent that one of the things that really troubled the naval cryptographers was that they couldn't use cryptography maths and cryptography proofs to explain why this worked. And it took them sort of 7 or 8 years to sort of figure out a way of getting cryptographers to accept that this was like a good approach to giving people privacy. But yeah, it is. I think it was pretty a pretty big deal at the time, and sort of still is.
So I have a fun question: who's in charge of the Tor project? Is any but one person running it?
Yeah, so it's run by a foundation essentially. So I will get. I think they may have had a change of leadership, so I'm going to get the exact answer for this for you right now. Essentially, the technical team is still really led by Roger Dingledean and Nick Mattison. So they still lead a lot of the kind of core technical development of Tor. They lead kind of how it works, basically. They run a lot of that team. They've got a quite big community of people that work for it in a variety of different roles. I'm just trying to find who the actual board of directors are. Board directors. Because I would like to actually get this correct.
When you look at your screen, it lights your face up. It's really funny.
Nice. Stop, sir. There, see you. Because it's changed recently, which is why I'm looking at this. So they've got a lot of people on the board of directors. And I'm trying to find out who they are. Oh, yeah, it's Isabella. Sorry, yes. So, because I've forgotten that surname. Fernandez, that's it. Sorry, yeah. So Isabella Fernandez is the executive director of the Tor project, so the kind of non-profit that runs Tor. They've got a kind of quite classic non-governmental organization structure. So you have the kind of the techies and the people that build the codes, and you have a board of directors above that that run it as a non-profit. So they manage the community, they manage funding, they manage reporting, they sort of do all the project management and HR stuff around that as well. That was a relatively recent development, so that kind of took place over the last sort of 10 years. The first sort of 10 years of the organization, it was a bit haphazard. They had a sort of more foundation model, where they had directors who contributed to the running of the organization, but it more worked like a sort of open software foundation rather than a non-profit that got lots of money in and did a lot of work that was organized. And the big change there was really around the kind of the huge boom in the digital rights movement globally. So during and after the Arab Spring, you see huge, and actually after that, with the Snowden revelations, of kind of mass spying around the world, you see by the US government, you see huge amounts of money, people, time, work pouring into digital rights. And to manage that, to manage the sort of money available, to manage the growth of Tor, a lot more people from a kind of activist and NGO background came into the project rather than kind of the core technical people that kind of actually build the software and do the engineering. And that's kind of where it is to date. Yeah. So it's run by this kind of board that decide the kind of policy and the direction of the organization. And underneath that, you've got the engineers that kind of make essentially technical decisions.
Have you seen an increase in what may be law enforcement presence on Tor, looking to find evildoers? Because that seems to be a big, concentration of the Trump legal administration, or illegal administration, whatever it is.
100%, yeah. So there's been a huge increase in not so much on the technical side. A lot of people get very worried about the CIA or the NSA compromising Tor's like technical infrastructure to make it not work. So we don't really see a lot of that. People kind of think they've picked this up time and again, but actually Tor's got a lot of quite good protections against that. What we do see is law enforcement using Tor. So they either use Tor to give themselves privacy. So Tor is actually a great tool for law enforcement because it means you can go on people's websites and spy on them without them knowing who you are. But also it's a very good tool for basically if all of your people committing crime are at one watering hole, that's kind of the place to go. And it's pretty easy to know where they are. So we see a lot of, for a long time, it was mostly private companies, private security companies, who would set up fake accounts on darknet websites. Pretend to be criminals, pretend to be into drug dealing, all this sort of stuff, hacking, and sell that information back to law enforcement, essentially. But law enforcement have started doing a lot more of this collection themselves. So if you are on basically any accessible darknet website, there will be a proportion of law enforcement on there, essentially, or at the very least, kind of security companies. And there is obviously the old joke that, you run a forum with 15 people and 14 of them are FBI agents. And it's never got quite to that level, but it's not necessarily always that far off either.
Yeah, one of their favorite methods of finding evildoers, or what they could consider evildoers, is setting up a honeypot or something like that to attract them in and try to get them to, commit a crime in the presence of law enforcement.
Yeah, this is the big thing now. A lot more of this stuff going on for cybercrime now over the last couple of years. So particularly the UK's National Crime Agency, a lot of the major UK police forces and the FBI are getting much more interested in these kind of complex deception operations where you, for example, a classic tactic they use increasingly in cybercrime communities is they'll set up a bunch of cybercrime services. They'll just sort of leave them there. They own them. And then they'll take down a lot of illicit ones, so a lot of the illegal services that are out there. And when that happens, the criminals go trying to find other services. They find the law enforcement ones. They put their username and passwords in, which is the same as the ones they use for their Gmail, or they put their home address in, they put all their private data in, they don't use a VPN, so they expose who they are. And that essentially means that law enforcement get all of their information and a lot of evidence of them trying to commit crime.
That's the story that Joseph T Cox told in The Dark Wire, right? About was it Anom, the it was an encrypted messaging service that became quite popular among criminals, and it turned out that actually the FBI had set it up.
Yes, so there's quite a lot of this going on. Either law enforcement setting up their own services, compromising services, but not telling the criminals that they've got that access. So things like EncroChat, and actually just setting up their own services kind of whole cloth. A lot of the time now, when they take down a service, they leave it up. So they'll take it over, they'll arrest the admin, but they'll leave the service up. So they've got all this kind of continuing basically playground where they can mess with people, they can destroy people's reputations, and they can kind of collect intelligence on what people are up to.
There's a hilarious story in Dark Wire where I forget what he was deal what contraband he was dealing in, but he accepted the bona fides of some of a prospective customer because the customer had access to this already compromised encryption messaging system, and he figured he wouldn't have access if he wasn't genuine, and of course he was actually a policeman.
Yes, that's the big. I mean, when people try to make arguments against encryption, against kind of anonymity service like Tor, they always say, oh, it's a huge boon to criminals and it makes it really difficult for law enforcement. If law enforcement really put their mind to it, they've not usually got much problem in compromising people, even who are using these sorts of services, to be honest. None of us get it right on security 100% of the time. And law enforcement are more than happy to take advantage of those opportunities.
Well, they definitely managed to take down the Silk Road, right?
Yes, and again, that was a basic error of operational security. He'd used his same username on a separate service. He'd managed to link it to who he was, and then actually and just took him down in person, more or less. They distracted him, snatched his laptop. And so before he could have a chance to lock it. So yeah, it's a lot of the time people focus too much on the technology. Most of the time when people get caught, it's basic, quite human stuff. They make mistakes, they trust the wrong person, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you get cocky and you start being more and more careless. And I
Absolutely.
guess that's what happened with him. I just wonder about like how all of this affects the balance of power, I guess. I mean, is Tor really having an impact on the distribution of power? At least as it relates to internet communications.
I think yes. So it's a really difficult and complex debate around what the effect of technologies like Tor are on power online. But I think that's the most interesting question about Tor because it's really difficult. I think technologies like Tor stop you building up the kind of at least put in blockers to building up that kind of like automated, technical, centralized surveillance and control of people, which I think, having worked as a civil servant myself, having spent a lot of time with police and security services interviewing them, that the view of the world you get from that seat is quite worrying. It's quite paranoid. You just see problems everywhere and you think, well, it's my job to kind of stop all this bad stuff happening. And when you see problems that seem to come from technology, you think there must be a technological solution. These engineers have caused all these problems. Can't we get the engineers to design us a solution? The problem is those solutions don't work very well and they create a really horrible world to live in, and not a world I think many people would like to live in, of sort of automated judgment, automated surveillance, this kind of risk profiling based on everything you're doing. And I think technologies like Tor, particularly just now, when we're living currently through a massive potential technological change, through sort of the rise of generative AI and chatbots as being the increasingly how a lot of people get, a lot of people, not everyone, but how a lot of people get information about the world, how a lot of people experience the digital world, that's incredibly centralized. So rather than having lots and lots of different websites and services and providers, suddenly you've got like four. And they control all of your access to information. They sort of can see everything you're up to, and they can tell you kind of how the world works based on what they think, their politics. And that's not the internet I grew up with in the 1990s. I think that's not what a lot of people growing up who were in the 1990s who liked the internet wanted the internet to be. And I feel like Tor, whether it actually does really redistribute power, is a kind of vote of confidence. It's a kind of, I don't know, it's some sort of remnant of that utopian vision of the internet as something that could actually be good, that doesn't necessarily have to centralize power in my tiny number of often quite horrible people, and actually is a bit more distributed. So I
Well,
think,
you
yeah.
have what you might call surveillance monopolies, and using something like Tor or something like Signal, these are ways that you can, to some extent, hide from that surveillance, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's, yeah, I think one of the things that you're really seeing now is a lot more interest in these technologies, particularly Signal. I mean, like, as we've seen over the last 6 months, high-ranking members of the US government use Signal. You know, it's a popular technology that clearly people want to use. And I think as we enter, particularly the way that geopolitically the world is changing just now, I think that balance of the security that privacy technologies give you is increasingly valuable to people. Particularly, I mean, if you're a private company wanting to operate in the UK just now, do you trust the UK government? Like, would you trust my government not to spy on you, to try and steal the technologies you're developing, to give them to a British company? Not necessarily. And so there's a lot of different groups, I think, who are increasingly valuing the protections that privacy technologies give us.
There are many ways that people can protect their private security and privacy, but a lot of them are too complicated for many others. A lot of common folk just don't have either the time or the knowledge to go out and use any of these things, like Tor or Signal or any of these things. So how can people overcome this, problem of getting access to this kind of useful technology?
I totally agree. This is a huge problem, and I think it's a problem with. It's very interesting. I was at an event last week with some sort of techie lawyers, and they said, "Oh yeah, we all love the open source movement," but one of them had been speaking to an open source person who said, "Yeah, you should feel like you're living in a house when you're using open source technologies. You should feel like you're living in a house that's constantly under construction." No one wants that. No one. I've lived on a house that's under construction. It's not much fun. We want things to work. We want them to work easily. Some of us do obviously love technology, love messing around with it. That's not the average person. And I love the open source movement, but when I speak to people, when I try to collaborate with them, I don't use LaTeX. I use Google Docs. And so that I think it really is on the engineers there to build these components of privacy technologies into technologies that the general public use. A really good example of this, and kind of props, I never give props to Meta, but props to Meta on this one. I mean, they're not the originally people who did this, but like WhatsApp is a genuinely secure end-to-end encrypted messenger that incorporates a lot of technologies that were developed for Signal. Similarly, a lot of the technologies in Firefox that prevent fingerprinting were originally developed for Tor. And I think that it's that kind of this kind of multi-use model where you have very, very secure tech like Tor and Signal develop open technologies that can then be incorporated into tech the general public use. That really does help them. The general public shouldn't need to know it's using a secure technology. It should just be built into the background.
And the many failures of attempts to market privacy technologies in the 1990s that failed are evidence of that. And it's absolutely right that the more people use privacy technology, the more private we all are. You know, I mean, everybody's privacy took a hit when everybody started, when everybody else you knew started using Gmail. Because even if you didn't use it, all your email ended up there because everybody else was using it.
Absolutely. And another example of that is the random influencers taking videos of people in public, which I don't like at all. I don't want to be in the background of someone else's sort of influencer video very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to escape. I found something funny on Wikipedia. So there's a list of Tor sites on Wikipedia, and under these commerce sites that they have listed here, you notice they're all defunct.
Yeah.
All of them.
So this
and
is
that's
really,
kind of, yeah, go ahead.
So yeah, this is a really interesting feature of .NET marketplaces, is that there are two things that make .NET marketplaces rubbish for long-term crime. One of which is that because Tor, essentially, the Tor network is a large series of pipes interconnected together, it's very easy to fill those pipes up. And so they're very easy to denial of service attack these websites. So you can knock these, because it's a little bit fragile, you can knock .NET websites off the internet very, very easily. And actually law enforcement have started doing this as well. Just sort of, it's hard to take them down, but it's easy to stop people accessing them. The other problem is one of anonymity itself. So if you're totally anonymous, so commerce requires trust. And that means anonymity is quite difficult to bring into contact with commerce, because what stops you paying someone £100 for some marijuana? What stops them just taking your money, right? So with these websites, they came up with a way around that. They said, well, okay, there'll be two things we'll do. The first one is we'll have a reputation system like eBay. Now, obviously, you can game that. So if you're the police, you can just transact between each other, give each other a very good reputation, and then scam loads of people out of money so that they stop using the website. The other problem is, the other way they do it is through escrow. So essentially, when you give your money to the website, they hold it, the site itself holds your money until the other person says, yes, I've received my marijuana, whatever it is. What that means is that over time, as these marketplaces grow and grow and grow, suddenly they are holding larger and larger amounts of money at any given time. And the amount of money held in escrow is just growing and growing and growing. And the risk to them of being nobbled by law enforcement is also growing and growing and growing. So the incentive for you to just take all that money and say, see you all later, I'm taking your money and never seeing you again, grows exponentially over time, as the risk to you from law enforcement grows, as all this other stuff grows. So we see exit scams, we see denial of service, and obviously good old-fashioned criminal infighting take a lot of these sites down.
God, there's so much crime now.
Yeah, true.
It's really starting to weigh on me. You know, this morning I started, I was looking at, so I think everybody now is getting text messages where they'll say, hey, let's go to dinner tonight or something like that, right? And, you know, they're like pig butchers, basically. They're trying to, like, draw you in so that they can take all your money. And, one of the things I was learning about that is that the people who send you those messages are often people who are practically enslaved. They're like, you know, maybe they've been trafficked in some way, and you know, they're sort of like in some sweatshop, and there's probably some guy standing over them with a gun or something like that. And it's like, there's huge numbers of these people, and you think, How could anybody possibly fall for that? But enough people are falling for it that they are actually, you know, getting a return on their investment. And I guess kind of where this is relevant to Tor is, to what extent do you think people are using Tor to mask or you know, to remain under the radar, if not unfindable, at least very difficult to find when they're operating these kinds of criminals-like operations?
That's really interesting. There's kind of two things there. The first one is that on the actual, do these people use Tor? Almost none of them do. That's the really weird thing. When you look at cybercrime as a service people, they're almost always just using sort of dodgy VPNs rather than like anything actually good. They're usually not that smart, they're not that technical, and they're actually kind of don't really know anything about the thing they're doing. And that's because of a really odd change. So we studied this. We had a paper I'm really proud of called Cybercrime is Often Boring, which was about this big shift in cybercrime from the 1990s to now. So in the 1990s, it was very much like kind of pre-industrial revolution cybercrime. So you had these individual craftspeople that would become incredibly skilled at every aspect of kind of the hack. They develop their own technologies and tools. They do everything from start to finish themselves, and they produce a kind of bespoke criminal product at the end. And just like in the Industrial Revolution, that changed. They realized that they could actually just package this all up and get a bunch of low-paid workers to run it for them at a much larger scale. And so that's the birth, exactly as you say, of cybercrime as a service. So it's very much the sort of Industrial Revolution in cybercrime. Suddenly, if you've got these attack scripts, you've got these like bits of infrastructure, you don't have, need to have a clue how they work. You just need a couple of basic user manuals. You give them to a bunch of people to run them for you, and you just sit back and watch the money come in. And that means that now, when you look at these criminal enterprises, most of the people involved don't really know anything about technology. They're sort of able to get it to work just about, but it's much the same as the difference between someone that's able to build, a beautifully tailored shirt entirely from scratch as a handicraft person to someone that's sort of, sewing one tiny bit of a shirt and then passing it on to the next person. So it's that kind of industrialization of cybercrime that means a lot of them don't really know anything about technology and aren't very good at kind of securing themselves.
Well,
But yeah.
back in the early days of maybe I would call it medieval internet, when we were getting started and doing all sorts of interesting things, the companies, like Apple and Microsoft, they were, questionable sometimes, but they were pretty open about letting people do stuff with their computers. Now Apple is starting to enforce their beliefs, I guess, on the App Store, deleting things like the Spot Ice application that they recently deleted just because the government thought it was a bad idea. Is there
Absolutely.
any hope for these big companies to not be so helpful to people that don't need that kind of help?
It's very difficult. I totally agree. We're going through another era of really clamping down on tech. It's a pity. I go through phases myself. Sometimes I love being able to open up the tech I use, play around with it, get it to work differently. Other times I just think, God, I just want this thing to work. And the problem is just now, people talk about the younger generation being digital natives. The students I teach know nothing about technology. They know far less. They don't know what a file system is. They don't know how the things they use work. And that's explicitly because they've been designed to hide all that from the people that use them. And we're going through another layer of that now, particularly with this sort of chatbot revolution, where increasingly, people will barely be aware they're using a computer, or how it works at all, how that answer that comes back has been generated in the slightest.
I've said
And I
this for
think,
years that
yeah.
the digital natives are the people who built the damn thing.
Totally agree. Yes. So I
It is
think.
the most maddening bit of mythology that has, some guy made a lot of money writing a book about digital natives, and you cannot get it out of people's heads. And yet, and everybody talks about, oh, the younger generation is so much, but often they're not. I mean, the younger, yeah, kids are a huge demographic, just like seniors are. I mean, one of my friends is 82. She thinks she's not very good at a phone until she started talking with one of her friends and started giving her tech support.
Well, yes. I mean,
I mean,
it really annoys me when people say, particularly, I always get people in our informatics department saying, oh, simplify it. Pretend you're talking to your
your
grand.
mother.
And you're like, my grand was, I know a lot of people of that age who were like coders in Bletchley Park or, like were building the early internet, like women in their like 70s and 80s now. who do you think was doing it?
Years ago, Andy Hopper, who was a big research scientist guy in Cambridge for a while, in the space of about 15 minutes, he said something about your grandmother, equating her with the clueless user. And I got so mad that I went home and I wrote a Net Wars column entitled, "Your Grandmother is Smarter Than You Think."
Quite right.
That's good.
And I illustrated it with a picture of Granny Clampett from the Beverly Hillbillies with a rifle pointing at the reader.
Oh, that's crazy. I should ask the question. Somebody actually gave me a question to ask you. I said, I'm going to be talking to somebody about Tor. And they sent me a question. They wanted to know if you have any particular suggestions based on your research for people who are hosting exit relays.
Oh yeah, I do. So there's a bit of complexity here. This has changed a little bit. So what we used to have said, so when the network was really big and it was like really diversified, so it was lots of medium-sized and small-sized nodes that ran a lot of traffic. I would say don't host an exit node. So an exit node's the last stage in the connection to the website. So if you run an exit node, it looks like your computer is trying to access every website that everyone on the Tor network is trying to access. So if the police go to your internet service provider and say, "What's Ben Collier looking at?" If I run an exit node, it's like, illegal stuff, basically, a lot of the time, random bits of browsing, but generally the stuff people don't want you to see that you're looking at. So it can make you look like a sort of mastermind, super criminal, serial killer, which is not what anyone really wants. So what we would usually say, I say we, but I don't work with the Tor project, but what the Tor project would usually say is, if you run an exit node, get yourself listed as an internet service provider intermediary, basically. Set up a kind of charitable structure, something like that, a small scale nonprofit to just say, look, I run this as an ISP, so you don't need to get at, you don't need to knock my door down. And that does make the difference between the police kicking down your door or writing you a letter to say one of your customers is doing something bad. So that makes a big difference. I would say now, so that was what I would have said up until about 5 years ago. Now the Tor network's changed a bit. It's kind of professionalized. So it's still great to run a Tor node if you want to volunteer, you want to kind of contribute to the network. Probably don't run an exit node, probably run a middle node. So that kind of just contributes general capacity to the network without a lot of risk. If you really want to help the Tor network, you're probably better off finding an organization that runs lots of really big Tor nodes and giving them some money. If you run it yourself, it's like a really cool project. It's interesting. It gives you stuff to do. You can educate yourself. It's a useful way to learn more about system administration, about privacy. But if you really want to help the network, I would say find an organization like Tor servers and give them some money to kind of run a bit of the network.
So we're kind of getting close to running out of time here. We got a couple of minutes left, and we've been talking so much about dark web stuff and crime and so forth. So maybe as we end our conversation, it would be good for you to say something about the very positive use cases for Tor.
Yeah, there's loads. I mean, so it's used a lot by journalists, so particularly whistleblowers use it a lot. It's a really good way to get secret documents to journalists if you want to expose something bad that's going on. There's a few services that are dedicated to that. It's very good if you're running a news website or a kind of social website that's blocked in a lot of countries. It's very good for getting people in those countries to read your stuff. If you host it on Tor, it means they can read it much more easily. It's also there's a lot of organizations that use Tor for activism. So Women on Web is a really good example of this. So Women on Web is a kind of I think they're sort of affiliated with Women on Waves, and what they do is they provide reproductive health care to women all around the world in places where that's illegal. And so they use Onion services, they use Tor to kind of protect and allow people to access their services where it's blocked. But to be honest, like a lot of the really good use cases, yes, there's the journalistic stuff, yes, there's the kind of activist stuff. A lot of the really good use cases are just day-to-day web browsing. If you don't want the government spying on you, if you don't want the government, if you're from a particularly vulnerable population, it's really a good way to kind of protect yourself online in general.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ben. This has been a great conversation.
Oh, Fab, thank you so much for having me. It's been great to meet you, John and Scoop, and it's lovely to see you again, as always, Wendy.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.